Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Hi everyone, how are you? I hope that your week is going well so far. Thanks for all your lovely messages about last week's episode with Gino De Campo. I'm so pleased you enjoyed it as much as I did. And as many of you pointed out, the show he was trying to remember at the end was in fact called Fantasy Island. So go and check that out if you want to see what inspires Gino to go to Hawaii. I am just back from the Cotswolds. I was invited to stay at a new opening in Oxfordshire that has been really hyped in the travel world called Estelle Manor. It's just a couple of hours drive from London. It's a hotel and a private members club set in a magnificent Grade 2 listed landmark house, and it's surrounded by over 3,000 acres of beautiful parkland and gardens. And really, it had everything that you'd need for a perfect countryside holiday, from a spectacular heated outdoor pool that's heated all year round, surrounded by the prettiest pinstripe parasols and sunbeds, and a couple of cool bars, for amazing restaurants. There are a ton of outdoor pursuits that you can book, and there's the most incredible kids club for little ones with a huge and very classy indoor soft play. I have to say, I have been really dreaming of going back there this week. My daughter turned one and a couple of days later came down with chickenpox, not contracted at Estelle Manor, I should add. And yeah, I have been really dreaming of the clear blue skies and crisp autumn air of Estelle Manor when I have been stuck inside with no childcare. It's been so popular that it's continuing to grow, so it's one to watch for sure, and felt like such a treat. So thank you, Estelle Manor, for having us. And today's guest is also a fan of the countryside, growing up around farms and wildlife. TV presenter Kate Humble has always had a fascination for nature. After leaving school, she travelled solo to Africa, working her way from Cape Town all the way to Cairo. On her return to the UK, she began working for TV production companies as a runner and then researcher on the holiday programme. And it was on her second day there when she was asked by the programme's editor if she had ever presented before. No, she said, and nor do I want to. Kate has been presenting programmes for over 20 years since, as well as writing articles and books, many with a focus around travel. In fact, she is now a beloved mainstay of British TV, having presented some of our most iconic shows, including Spring Watch, Autumn Watch, Country File, Lambing Live, and many, many more. We spoke at the Chelsea Townhouse, a new opening by Iconic Luxury Hotels. They're the brand behind some of Britain's most legendary properties like Chewton Glen and Cliveden. It's another hotel that's been really hyped and has only just opened its doors, so it was great to have a little look. It's tucked behind one of London's most fancy shopping districts, Sloane Street, and Kate and I sat in one of their homely suites overlooking its lovely garden and treetops. Really an unusual outlook when you're in the heart of London. Kate is what I would consider a true traveller. She is someone who sets off with pure wanderlust, with a map and hiking boots and a rucksack, and gets stuck in wherever she's heading. She tells us today about an extraordinary 5 weeks spent with a tribe who live north of Timbuktu in the Sahara Desert, trading salt. She tells us about hiking through Afghanistan, exploring the rainforests of Borneo, and tracking wildlife in Madagascar. There is so much to cover today, so fasten your seatbelts, everyone, and let's get started. Kate Humble, welcome to the Travel Diaries. It is so nice to see you today. Thank you for coming all the way to London to see me. How are you?
I am very well. I know it's always slightly nerve-wracking coming back to the big city from the Welsh countryside, but it's lovely to be here.
Tell me about where you live, because I know it's just such a beautiful spot.
It is. I live in the Wye Valley, which as a travel journalist, you will know, was one of the first places in Britain to become a tourist attraction. Mm. And it was thanks to an amazing, one of those sort of Victorian polymaths called William Gilpin, who he was a vicar. They were always vicars. But he was also a writer and an artist. And the Wye Valley inspired him to come up with a new word for particularly spectacular landscapes. And that word is picturesque.
No way.
Yeah. And what he wrote about the Wye Valley then inspired people like Coleridge and, you know, and all sorts of poets and writers and thinkers to come to the Wye Valley. And it became one of the first tourist attractions.
Hmm. Does it feel touristy around where you are?
Not particularly, amazingly, given that I live quite close to Tintern Abbey, which is one of the most beautiful buildings, albeit ruined. But, you know, it is a very atmospheric ruin. There's always been, for some reason, a bit of a, you know, you have to cross over into Wales. And people, there's a sort of... There's been a kind of historical barrier, I think. You know, I mean, there is the literal border and there's Offa's Dyke, of course, which is right there. But it's people who know the Wye Valley and discover it absolutely love it. But it doesn't feel like it's not the sort of place that inspires mass tourism, mainly because there aren't any big towns nearby. And there aren't, you know, there aren't kind of obvious attractions. It's one of those places that you go and you discover it yourself, either on foot or you go canoeing or you cycle. But it's a place that you sort of have to make a little bit of an effort, but that effort is 100% worth it.
I mean, I have rediscovered it through the Netflix series Sex Education, which is filmed there. And the kind of vistas and how picturesque it looks. I mean, they really sell it, don't they, in terms of its beauty?
Absolutely. I mean, Sex Education was literally filmed about two villages up the valley from where I live.
No way, that
and
close.
So that lower Wye, that's the sort of lower Wye Valley, which is the section between Chepstow and Monmouth, is very steep-sided. It's quite dramatic landscape. There's a lot of forest. The river is kind of tucked down into a sort of ravine almost. It's very green. You get this wonderful thing that is known locally as the dragon's breath, and it's starting to happen. It tends to happen in the autumn, so it'll just start to happen now. And it's the temperature inversion when you have cold air and the warmer water of the river, and you get what looks like dry ice. It looks like a 1970s pop video. you get this sort of low mist that hangs over the river, and because of the steep-sided valleys, you get this sort of magical mist.
Like
and
mythical.
Then the, exactly. Yeah. And you know, and lots of things like Merlin and stuff have been filmed around that area as well. So it does have this very kind of mythical, magical feel about it. It is glorious. And I can't really believe that every morning I wake up and walk out into that landscape. It makes my heart lift every time.
So good for the soul.
Really is.
So today, Kate, we're going to go on a journey through the seven chapters of your life's travel diaries.
Yes.
I mean, so much travel to cover today, but we're going to probably just scratch the tip of the iceberg. We go back to the very beginning for chapter one, and that is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Well, my earliest childhood travel memories is perhaps a surprise to you, given how much I have traveled now in my life. I wasn't a very good traveler. I was the most carsick child ever invented.
Okay.
We lived a mile outside a village, and I would throw up just going to the village shop.
Oh my gosh.
So my earliest childhood travel memories are of being in the car in the back and saying to my parents, "Are we nearly there?" I mean, literally, it was the, "Are we nearly there yet? Because I need to be sick again." And it was the misery. It was the misery of travelling, of being in the car. And I can remember a journey. We'd been to see my grandmother who lived in Hertfordshire, which wasn't very far away. And it felt like we'd been in the car forever and ever and ever. And of course, you have to remember, Holly, that I'm quite old. So, you know, this was the sort of 70s.
She certainly doesn't look it.
Thank you. she's being kind. But so this is the 70s. So, you know, no one had invented kind of in-car entertainment. You had to pay a lot of iSpy through the window and that kind of thing. And so there we were, and cars were quite uncomfortable, and you stuck to the plastic seats and those sorts of things. And I remember saying, how far is it till we get home? And Dad saying it was 34 miles, and 34 miles felt like 34,000 miles. Yeah. So I didn't have a very happy or auspicious start to my travelling career. I basically didn't want to travel at all.
So, I mean, I'm assuming you've grown out of that since.
A little bit, but I can't really read in a car. Mm-hmm. If I have to map read, and again, apologies to everyone who doesn't know what that means, because they've always used sat nav and map apps. Map reading isn't good on windy roads. And funnily enough, and I don't know whether this is a reflection of the cars that I grew up with, but posh cars, you know, very kind of well sprung. I don't spend much time in posh cars, I hate to add, but those posh cars, they're the worst.
Really? Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think it's all that sort of cushioning. I think if you're kind of, you know, properly bounced about a bit, you're all right.
Yeah, and brain is probably being distracted by the other things going on.
Exactly. And I have done some spectacularly uncomfortable road journeys in the years since, you know, in kind of, I travelled through Guatemala and parts of Mexico, and quite often the buses, if you were taking a bus, were old American school buses made for children. So, and I'm, you know, 5'9", so I'm relatively tall, and you just couldn't fit in the seat. You know? I've done some quite uncomfortable road journeys. Never sick on those. Put me in something posh, and I'm hopeless.
Well, we have something in common, because we're both travel journalists, travel writers, and I get motion sickness on planes, which is also not ideal.
Not ideal. No.
So you're okay on planes?
Well, so here's the other thing. I have had to teach myself to be not terrified of flying. So, I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing. My one grandfather, my mother's father, was in the RAF in the war, was a rear gunner, was one of the bravest men ever. My other grandfather, my dad's father, was a test pilot. So also insanely brave. Yeah. And, you know, flew. That was his life. He flew. And then I come along and really would much rather never get in a plane ever. And I didn't. You know, that was the other thing. As a child, we didn't go abroad. You know, people didn't go on foreign holidays then because it was just too expensive. I mean, you just didn't do it.
There weren't budget flights. It wasn't that kind of culture.
I didn't go on a plane really until my very late teens, probably. Actually, no, that's not quite true. I think there was one time where my mum said, I am just not going to another holiday cottage and just sweating away in somebody else's kitchen again. And also, you know, it used to rain a lot. Yeah. You know, the weather has changed, actually. You know, British summers were famously bad. And so there was one time when I was about possibly 12, I think that might have been the first time I went abroad, and we went to Corfu. But other than that, I'd never been on a plane. And I was terrified. And as I got older, it got worse. And
as it often does, actually.
As it often does.
Like, I used to not care at all when I was younger either.
Yeah, yeah. And I got to a stage where I had to take beta blockers to go to an airport. Let alone get on a plane. And I had this slightly embarrassing, although it's kind of a lovely story because it's a story about kindness. I was trying to wean myself off having to take beta blockers to get on a plane because it's not ideal. And also everyone thinks that you might have taken something illegal and then you get searched quite a lot. I was patted down in no uncertain terms in Lusaka Airport once. I thought I was flying up to Edinburgh. I was doing some work at the Edinburgh Festival, and I thought, right, this is perfect. It's a really short flight. I don't need to take beta blockers to get on this plane. So I'm standing at the queue to get on the plane, and I get the palm sweat and the heart racing, and I'm just thinking, I can't get on the plane. I can't. And I had the pills with me just in case. So I took, of course, it's not good. I mean, you know, I needed half an hour at least for them to kick in. So they didn't kick in. So I sit down on the plane, and I'm in an aisle seat, and it was the kind of red eye, you know, so there's quite a lot of businessmen on this flight. And there was a businessman sitting next to me, and it was in the days when if you got on a plane, you got fed. You didn't have to buy some horrible roll, you know, you actually got food. It was quite a nice experience in those days. So I'm sitting there and I'm holding on to the armrests and clearly knuckles white. And the man, the businessman, you know, in his suit and everything, clearly noticed that I was looking like I was about to have a meltdown. And he said, I hope this isn't an inappropriate question, but would you like me to hold your hand? And I was like, yes, please.
Oh.
And I got hold of his hand, poor, and I didn't let go for the whole flight. He's trying to eat his breakfast with one hand, and I'm gripping this poor man's hand. Don't let go, just don't let go of me, don't let go of me. And it was so, so kind. And yes, it took me a long time to be able to fly and not think about it. It was in the end, it was a case of just doing it so much that I didn't have the energy to be scared anymore.
I think a lot of the listeners will find that story really comforting, because when you get on a plane, you see everyone, you know, especially on long haul flights, they're putting on their pajamas and they're putting on their masks. And I'm looking around being like, how are you guys so relaxed? Like, you're getting ready for your 8 hours of sleep. Like, what the actual, like, this is definitely not something I could ever engage with.
Yeah.
But then the more that you kind of speak to people, you realize actually that a lot of people do have anxiety about flying in all kinds of different ways.
Yes.
So yeah, I think it's kind of relatable.
Yes.
And you've still managed to travel the world. We all find our ways to manage.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. A really good book, and noise cancelling headphones. That was the game changer, discovering those.
Yes. Yeah, that is a big deal. Now I've got a baby, those noise cancelling headphones.
Yeah.
Can't really wear those anymore. Shame. But you still had a real desire to travel from a young age, it seems, because leaving school and home at 18 and then going off to Africa on your own, I mean, that is an innate intrepidness.
Well, that's very sweet of you to call it that. I think my parents would call it teenage rebellion and just being kind of, you know, arsy for the sake of it, probably. But I've always had, and I think, you know, if someone were to ask me, what's the thing that you, asset isn't quite the right word, but let's call it an asset, because I certainly see it as an asset. What is the thing that you were born with that you feel luckiest? Good health is one. But the other is this absolutely unquashable sense of curiosity. And, you know, It's really what led me to do what I do, you know, the TV work, the writing and the traveling have all come from just being kind of nosy, actually, but just wanting to find things out. And when I left school in 1987, and I went to a very rigid, very academic school. I basically spent 6-7 years, whatever it was, learning how to take and pass exams. And to me, that's not education. So when I left school, even though the whole point of me being there, what I'd been channeled towards, was to go to university, the last thing I thought I was going to do was that. And admittedly, you know, it was a long time ago, but it wasn't that different from now. You know, you were still told, if you don't go to university, your life is basically going to be over. You will get you will never be given a proper career. You will never be able to, you won't be a success. And I thought, well, I don't know, I'm just going to do things differently. And all my friends who were going to university, a lot of people were taking gap years. And that was a relatively well-established thing, but very different from now. So they weren't organized. You know, now people go on organized gap years, which I find a little bit disappointing and a little bit sad. In my day, people tended to go, they would get a ticket to India, they get a ticket to Australia. Those were the sort of two centres that people would go to. And there was a kind of back backpacker's route. And but everything was done by word of mouth, because of course there was no internet then, there was no, you know, there was no social media, so it was kind of done, as I say, by word of mouth. There were these wonderful old, the old travel guides, the kind of rough guides, and the Lonely Planets. My best friend at school, she and I had decided that we were going to go to Australia together. But the big difference was, when we left school, she was going to go to university. So she had a time limit of when she could go, because she had to come back. And she also, her parents had their own business. So she had worked for her parents' business and earned money to be able to go traveling.
Right.
I didn't have any money at all. But also, I didn't have a time limit. So basically, I had to spend the next few months earning the money to be able to go traveling and mm-hmm. go and meet her in Australia. So that was the plan. I would meet her. And while I was trying to earn the money, and I was living in a storeroom in a house in Oxford for £20 a week, all bills included, apart from the phone, and I was working in a pub at night and at weekends, and I was doing kind of temp secretarial work during the day, she would send me letters, those old airmail letters. Do you remember those lovely crispy
stickers
with the big stickers and that lovely lightweight crispy paper that was so exciting? And I would get these letters from her telling me what an amazing time she was having, but also saying, guess who I've bumped into? And some part of my, I don't know, I suppose my sort of obstreperous teenage brain went, I don't want to go to the other side of the world and meet people I know. I don't want to do that. And someone I'd met while I was doing my typing course, which, you know, was an awful thing to do, but actually has stood me in very good stead. Being able to type is quite a handy thing. As an anything now. I met a South African girl on the course. And, you know, in those days, South Africa was still in apartheid. South Africans weren't traveling very much. She was able to travel because actually her family were English, so she had an English passport. Anyway, she and I became great friends, and she started telling me about Africa. And I was like, oh my goodness, it sounds amazing. So suddenly I thought, I'm not going to go to Australia and see people I know. I'm going to go to Africa because why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I go?
Yeah.
And there was, I mean, I'm so ashamed of it now, because my parents, you know, were and remain the kindest, most encouraging, most wonderful people. And I knew it would shock them that I was going somewhere that was quite, you know, dangerous and dark, and, you know, no one really knew about Africa, you know. And I thought, that's why I want to go.
Yes.
That's why I want to do it.
That's and very brave, I think, as well.
I don't think it didn't feel brave. I was, by the time I'd saved up the money, so it took me 8 months, I can remember, to this day, I can remember, you used to check your bank account, you used to get, you know, statements sent with your bank account. And I can remember it took me 8 months from leaving school to have £1,000 saved up in my bank account. And I knew then I could go and buy the plane tickets. And I can remember the day seeing, I've got £1,000, £1,000. It was just like the most unbelievable amount of money. And going and working out the cheapest possible way. And I went on Air Zambia, which doesn't even exist anymore. It shouldn't really have existed then. It was a terrifying experience. But I bought my tickets and I went to Africa with no plan to come home. And really? By the time I left, I had £800 spending money, which I hid in my sock. I had my rucksack and I had Gigs, the girl I'd been at college with. I had her contact details and her family, and that was it. And, you know, and people say, gosh, it was brave. It's only brave when you are scared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Oh, that sounds so incredible. And so you're out in Africa. Chapter 2, Kate, is the first place that you fell in love with. Was it that experience?
It completely was. I mean, I think it's funny. I suspect it's not unusual that people fall in love with the first kind of formative journey that they take, or the country that they take their formative journey in, and there is something about the continent of Africa. You know, it's a mistake often that people make is you just say Africa and kind of lump it into one country, but of course it's not. It's this glorious, complex, varied, astonishing continent, and I found it completely bewitching in all sorts of ways. You know, when you've come from the Berkshire countryside, and even just, I remember the first morning I was there, and I was staying in Giggs's parents' house in Johannesburg, and I looked out of the window, and on the grass outside were these two amazing birds just feeding on the grass, you know, just on the lawn. These like big, black, glossy, beautiful, long-billed birds. And I was like, what on earth are those? You know, I'm used to seeing sparrows and robins.
Yeah.
And they went, oh, they're just hardy-dars. And the hardy-dar is an ibis, but it makes a call. It goes, hardy-dar! And so they're known as haunted jars, obviously. And I was just, you know, amazed. I was amazed by that. And I remember doing a road trip, driving down to Cape Town, and again seeing this astonishing bird, this kind of lilac and turquoise bird, sitting on the wire of a telegraph, you know, telegraph wire, and again saying, stop the car, what's that? And they're like, oh, it's just a lilac-breasted roller, they're everywhere. And I'm like, I've never, you know. And so there's a lot of reasons why I still feel this leap of it's like seeing somebody you love when I go back to Africa, and to almost anywhere on the continent. And one is that it was a place that made me see nature in a new way. It made me appreciate than what we've got at home too. But yeah. It made me look at the natural world because it was strange. And I was absolutely, you know, enraptured by these extraordinary birds. I got a job as a truck driver for a safari company. Mm. And
where were you then?
So I drove from Cape Town through Botswana and finished at Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe. So
what a reach.
It was amazing. So the clients were all flown in light aircraft, and there was me and a guy, and we were basically carrying all the heavy stuff, all the camping equipment and all the food and everything else overland. And we had to drive. I remember we drove through the top of the Kalahari Desert, and it was so hot. We had bottles of water that we then made coffee with because it had just got to the point where, you know, it was ridiculous. And we tried frying eggs on the bonnet and all that kind of stuff. It was unbelievably boiling. But, you know, just... I had to spend this 19-year-old girl from Berkshire who knew nothing. I remember, you know, we were camping, and then it was just, I mean, we were wild camping. And one of our jobs as kind of the staff, sort of, was at night we had to guard the campsite. So I had to sit, we did shifts, and I had to sit by myself on the bonnet of the Land Rover with a searchlight shining it around, and there would be all these eyes in the bushes. I didn't know whether they were lion or whether they were, you know, springbok or what they were. But the idea was that we, you know, that we kept big predators out of the camp. Yeah, absolutely terrifying, but wonderful.
I imagine, did you find that quite exciting?
Incredibly exciting. I mean, yeah, it was just, I suppose, again, if you've been sort of, if you don't have a reason to be scared, I mean, it's quite a dangerous position to be in because you can, you know, feel completely overconfident. But it was incredible. And things like, you know, I'd never seen a night sky like it. And the sounds and the smell, there's something about the smell of, particularly when it rains and it falls on that dusty red earth. And I remember going back. I went back and did an extraordinary journey for a newspaper story. I went back to Cameroon, and I'd never been to Cameroon before. And the plane landed in Douala, and as I came off the plane, and I was just hit by the smell of hot red earth and just, I don't know, just the kind of, there's something about the quality of the air. And I just thought, I feel completely at home here, even though I've never been here before. And so part of why I fell in love with Africa was that, you know, was the natural world, was kind of like being slapped around the face by the astonishment that was the natural world. But it was also, and this is true, I think, of so many travel experiences for so many of us, it was people. It was the people. And I have never experienced kindness and generosity like it. Mm. And, you know, so many people who have so little will give you so much to make sure that you're safe and happy. And the as I say, the hospitality and the generosity that I received in that first trip, and I've been back to different parts of Africa. I mean, I ended up being there for the best part of a year. I traveled completely by myself. I hitched. I, you know, did all sorts of things that, you know, are probably massively inadvisable. But I was beautifully looked after, and I will... the African continent and the African people will remain so much part of my heart because of that.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. And if somebody of that age was to come to you now and say, I'd like to do something like that. Oh, I'd love to go to Africa on my own, maybe a woman in particular. What country would you tell them to go to first, do you think?
It's a really good question. And I'm not sure I know, really, because I think it so much depends on an individual. You know, I don't think There isn't a simple one answer like to a question like that.
All, yeah.
There isn't a one size fits all. And for some people, you know, going to, I mean, I remember I was in Ethiopia 1 year, and there were people that I met, you know, other foreigners, other tourists there. I was there for about 2 months and traveling completely just on public transport and camping and, you know, sort of quite off the beaten track stuff, and found it very, very difficult. It was a very difficult country to travel in for all sorts of reasons. And met other foreigners there who were really struggling, and they thought that was Africa. And I said, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this, there's just something about this country, about attitudes, about that make it a bit more challenging. But equally, you know, I've met people who've been there and been, you know, absolutely loved it.
So your great friend Ben Fogel came on the podcast.
Yeah.
His all-time favorite destination was Lalibela in Ethiopia. So he had a different experience.
He had a different experience.
Yeah.
And so I think it's sort of dangerous, really, to say to someone, oh, you should definitely go there or start there. We've all done it. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's your favourite restaurant even.
Yeah, and then, or hotel
or
as well.
You know, I always feel, you know, the kind of the web-based, the sort of TripAdvisor type things, you know, they're so subjective.
Totally.
And I think it is... You know, it's kind of, in a way, I just think, let your curiosity lead you. You know, make the decision yourself. If you want to do it, just do it. Mm. You know, and if you don't like it, there's no shame in that. Change. Go somewhere different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we move on to chapter three. Yes. And that is the place where you learned the most about yourself. Where would that be?
Well, I had, still have, really, an obsession with the old way that people travelled, or the old reasons why people travelled, and trade. You know, that was those old trade routes that crisscross the continents. I think that's fascinating. I think the history of those routes, how language and goods and, you know, everything was traded, cultures. It was a way of the world opening up. And I'd always been fascinated by those old routes and what they did, how they turned the world into the melting pot that it is today.
Yes.
And there was one route, and I can't remember the moment that I read about it or heard about it, but there was, and it was one of those really sketchy bits of sort of information that for some reason lodges in your head. And it was this. Salt is traded across the Sahara from Timbuktu. Now, that's not actually entirely correct, as I now know.
Okay.
But there was something about Timbuktu. I think anyone who has a traveller's bone in their body is intrigued by Timbuktu.
Yes.
Does it actually exist?
Yeah.
You know, is it a mythical place? Is it really there? And then for me, I've always been fascinated by deserts. There's something about that sort of space, that perception of emptiness. Is it really empty? You know, does really nothing happen there?
Mm.
You know, there's something kind of infinite about a desert. And, you know, what is it to be in a place like that? It is so alien to someone who has grown up, you know, in the southeast of England. So the kind of bewitching combination of Timbuktu, mythical place, Sahara Desert, the ultimate desert, and a trade route, someone trading salt, you know, a commodity that is absolutely the root of life and apparently had more value than gold at one point.
Mm.
So all those things kind of conspired to make me want to cross the Sahara with the salt traders of Timbuktu. Now, this was early 90s.
Right.
And so Internet, not really there. I start doing some research. I find there's an embassy. Mali has an embassy. First of all, I find out that Timbuktu does indeed exist. It's there, and it's in a country called Mali in West Africa. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, so I'm getting somewhere. Now, has Mali got an embassy in the UK? No, it doesn't, but it does have one in Brussels. So I get in contact with the embassy, and I say, I'm quite interested to go to Timbuktu. Is that possible? And they said, absolutely not. There's a war going on. And there was a war raging in northern Mali at that time, in the sort of early to mid-90s. And so I thought, okay, well, probably not the ideal time to try and do this journey. But the idea of doing that journey would not go away.
For TV or for just personal enjoyment?
Just for me. Just for
me. Like between jobs?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a freelance, you know. Yeah. That's the joy. I can do whatever I like.
Yeah.
Within reason. So I basically bided my time, but kept, you know, just sort of kept the eye on the situation. How's that war getting on? You know, what's going on? And eventually it gets to sort of beginning of 1999. The war is over. I'm back in touch with the embassy. They said, yes, the war is over. And I said, I'm interested in the salt trade. I didn't say I wanted to do it, because for some reason I thought maybe they wouldn't let me. So I just said, I'm interested in finding out more about the salt trade and whether it still happens. And, you know, and they said, oh, they put me in touch with an aid agency, with an American aid agency based in Timbuktu. And a lot of aid agencies had moved in during the war and based themselves on the outskirts of Timbuktu.
Right.
And by now, there was email. It was still in its infancy, and it was dial-up and all that going on. But I could email somebody in Timbuktu. Miraculous.
Yeah.
And so I emailed this American woman, and I said, and I explained, I kind of want to do a journey, and I'm just interested to know whether the traders are still trading. Are they, you know, does it still happen? And she came back and she said, I believe it does. There's not a great deal I can tell you. Really, if you want to find out more about it or do any part of the journey, you're just going to have to get here and find out for yourself.
Gosh. Right.
So I thought, okay. That's what I'll do then. And my husband was due to be going to France to do a documentary about volcanoes. He speaks fluent French and he's a filmmaker. And that's what he was supposed to be doing. And he's like, you cannot go and do this journey on your own. And I'm like, of course I can. I've done loads of traveling on my own. Of course I can. He said, your French is rubbish. And that's the colonial language. Mm-hmm. And he said, secondly, you know, how's this going to work? And I said, well, I've no idea, but it'll be fine. He said, I'm just really not comfortable about going on your own. Why can't you wait? And I said, I don't know, but I know I can't wait. I know I've got to do it. And at the same time, I was just, I'd say, breaking into presenting on television. I'd never wanted to be on television.
No,
I loved researching.
You were a researcher.
I was a researcher. I loved doing that. But I just, you know, I'd been doing some presenting and I'd been offered this really big series for BBC Two. And I said, I can't do it because I'm going to the Sahara. And they went, what? And I said, I'm going to the Sahara. I can't do this series because I'm going to the Sahara. And they looked at me like I was mad. And they said, go later. I said, I can't. You don't understand. This journey is done twice a year. It's done in November and it's done in January.
Oh, right. There are specific windows.
Because think about it. It's the Sahara. It's plus 50 and beyond during the day. So you have to do it in the winter months.
Yeah.
They do it twice because it is a monster journey. It is biblical and epic and takes 40 days, the round trip.
Right.
And, you know, you're traveling by a camel and you're traveling at night most of the time because even in the winter, it's so hot during the day. You know, you don't just pick and choose and say, oh, I'm going to turn up in March because it's more convenient to do a BBC series, or your husband's telling you can't go because he's busy filming in France.
I mean,
you
side
just
note,
have to get on with it.
If I was a BBC commissioner, I would so be like, okay, let's pivot this BBC programme to be this new concept because it is such a fascinating prospect.
Well, why don't you just apply for the job? You know, it would have been lovely. So I carried on with my plans, found flights to Bamako and thought, well, if I get to Bamako, which is the capital of Mali, I'll then be able to find a way, whether it's overland or internal flights or something, to get to Timbuktu. The American aid agency woman said, well, you know, I can help you out. We've got a really basic accommodation. You can stay here while, and I'll introduce you to the guy. It's a local guy who might be able to help with logistics and so on. And then, much, I think, to my husband's relief, and it has to be said, to mine in the end, his series was cancelled. And so he said, I'm going to come too. So we got to Bamako, we then went overland to Mopti, and then we got an internal flight. It was a Russian plane that was, I kid you not, was held together with masking tape. And we landed in Timbuktu, and I couldn't believe I was there.
Was it everything that you, well, you didn't, it was, felt mythical, so what
did,
was it?
It was partly the mythical. I mean, there were these incredible, you know, mud buildings with the kind of sticks that stuck out of them, these ancient libraries and things, but they looked like they grew out of the sand. So there were these ancient mud buildings.
Yeah.
But then this sort of odd contrast of the road that led into the main part of the city was lined with kind of aid agencies and all the kind of detritus of the war. And
right.
So it was this strange mix. I mean, you couldn't call it beautiful. There were beautiful bits of it. But what was so extraordinary was that it was there at all. You know, there was this habitation surrounded by sand.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, it really did feel like you'd kind of walk through the back of the Narnia wardrobe into I don't know what, you know, you couldn't really,
just seemingly so inhospitable.
Yeah, sort of but so unlikely. Why is it here? You know, what's it doing here? This ancient, sort of beautiful, but in a bleak kind of end of the world sort of feeling place.
Right, yeah.
And there were, you know, the Tuareg, these amazing nomadic people in their indigo robes and their turbans, and there were camels, and there were piles of dates and dust, and I mean, it was, and the light, I remember the light, the sky was, it was so bleached. It was almost kind of orange white, the sky, because of the sort of heat and the dust and the, I mean, it was extraordinary. It was like nowhere I'd ever, ever experienced. And the American aid agency lady, she was called Anne. I'll never forget her. She was so generous and so helpful. And she introduced us to Shindug. And Shindug tourists did get there. And he would take them out on camels into the desert, which was kind of just there. And they would go and have, you know, a couple of hours pottering around the desert on a camel and get a sort of Sahara experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, we don't want to do that. What we want to do is do the salt route. We want to go to the salt mines. And he said, but that's impossible. And I said, well, is it? I mean, is it really impossible? And he said, okay, well, let's sit down. How do you want to do this? And I said, well, tell me about the route. Tell me how it works. And he said, well, there are caravans that go. And he said, they're smaller now because after the war, a lot of the camels were killed. A lot of people were killed. Mm. A lot of these, there are two tribes, if you like, the Tuareg, who are the kind of, everyone knows of the Tuareg, you know, the indigo men. And then there are the Berabish. And the Berabish, they describe themselves as the ancestors of two separate brothers. So there was a warring brother, and he was the ancestor of the Tuareg. And then there was a peaceful brother, and he was the ancestor of the Berabish. So the Berabish are semi-pastoral nomads. Mm-hmm. They have their camels, they have their goats. They live in the kind of what they call the Petit Désert, the area around Timbuktu that has some vegetation, not very much, but sort of scrubby trees and things like that. And they're the ones that trade the salt. And they travel 1,500 kilometres north to almost the Libyan border, where there is a place that is like a Hieronymus Bosch vision of hell. And it is these salt mines that are mined by slaves. This is this is
99, yeah.
And they have slaves who work for them. So each trader has their slaves, and their slaves mine the salt by hand. It's because it's an old dried out sea, and there's three layers of the salt, and the deepest layer, which is a few meters down, is the purest, and the salt at the top is kind of rubbly and hopeless. So the slaves would mine the salt 6 days a week, and on the seventh day, whatever they mined was theirs to keep. So that was kind of how they were paid, if you like.
Right.
And their trader, at the end of the season, which was about 4 to 5 months, would bring back their slaves with their salt. That was sort of their payment. We will bring the salt back for you on our camels, because slaves don't have camels. Mm. And then the slaves could trade it, and that would be how they made their living.
Right.
So it was feudal. I mean, it was like medieval. It was absolutely medieval.
Did you know? I mean, had you read about that?
No,
had,
I didn't know it. I found all this out when I was there.
While you were there, right.
So, but what Shindu explained is that the caravans leave from all over, you know, all around about. He said it would be impossible for you to travel up with a caravan because you can't find them. They'll just leave from wherever their encampment is, and they, you know, they're nomadic. They just move around.
Yeah.
But he said what we could do is we could get a driver, and we could drive to the salt mines. I will negotiate with a caravan. Because we'll pay, you know, we weren't expecting this for nothing. We knew we would pay our way. He said, I'll negotiate with the caravan and you can travel back to Timbuktu with the caravan. We're like, great, that sounds perfect.
Mm.
Now, it turns out that Shinduk was something of a, I mean, he was a genius. Within 24 hours of us arriving in Timbuktu, he'd found a driver, a car, an off-road, you know, off-road vehicle, a guide, because driving across the Sahara, there's no roads. There were no roads. You basically need someone who can read the sand. Otherwise, we'd have been stuck in, you know, dunes and what have you. He took us to the market. He said, you have to wear what we wear. So I've still got mine. We had outfits, you know, robes and loose trousers and turbans. He said, you have to have a turban because it keeps the sun off your head.
Mm-hmm.
We bought dates, we bought rice, we bought millet, and we bought petrol, and we bought tea, and we bought sugar. And that was our supplies. And we set off literally within 24 hours of arriving in Timbuktu. We were driving. And we drove, we camped overnight in the sand, and then we set off the next day, and a large crucial part of the car fell off.
Fell off.
So clearly we weren't going to be able to go anywhere. So we managed to limp back to this little oasis place that we'd passed. And the idea was that we would send somebody by camel, because there were camels at that place, back to Timbuktu, and they would pick up another vehicle, or order another vehicle, effectively. And this might take a week. So we're like, fine, well, we'll just, you know. I mean, it'd been so smooth by now, up until now. It was almost disappointing. I'm thinking, this isn't an expedition. It's just kind of, it's like something you get out of a tourist brochure. So we're sort of happy about this. Anyway, as we're limping back to, you know, this little oasis settlement, we see a caravan of people, three men, 50-odd camels, heading north. And Shindu goes, oh, look, there's a caravan heading north. And we went, oh, yeah. And I went, hang on a minute. That's a they're doing what we want to do. And I said, can't we join them? And Shindu said, well, okay, I'll see. So he gets out of the car, and suddenly there's all this going on, you know, and you're like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Is this a good noise or a bad noise?
Yeah.
Anyway, it turned out it was a good noise. They all knew each other. And they were somehow related to Shindu. And so, poor things. Shindu, it was something to do with family structure. Shindu was kind of higher up in the family, as I say, the family tree.
Yeah.
So these poor men were not allowed to say, you have got to be kidding. There is no way we're taking two foreigners off with us to go and get the salt. They kind of had to agree. So we literally unpacked all our sacks of rice and tea and everything else. And Shindig said, well, I'm going to have to come with you because there's this great honor. It's a very Islamic thing. This, if you make an arrangement, you stick to it. And his arrangement was, mm-hmm. I said I would take you to the salt mines. So he said, I will come with you. I mean, thank goodness. I don't know what would have happened if he didn't. I'll come with you to the mines.
Yeah.
So we said, okay, fine. So basically, I mean, if I carry on telling you this story, the podcast will last about 4.5 hours. But I'm going to try and cut it short. But our journey started at that moment. I'd never ridden a camel or been on a camel in my life. I spent 5.5 weeks on a camel. The first day was so uncomfortable, I ended up walking. And don't think, you know, when you go to Egypt and you do a camel ride with a saddle, there's no saddles, there's no nothing. You're riding bareback. You have to kind of arrange yourself around the hump.
And you're an experienced horse rider.
I am. And they're very different from a horse.
Yeah.
And I had a camel. He was beautiful. I called him Duncan. He was white. He had enormous eyelashes. And he was very, very patient with me. But the first day, we travelled for about 11 hours. And I was so uncomfortable, I ended up walking most of it. And it was the hardest, physically and psychologically, the hardest journey I've ever done. I didn't see another woman in the entire time that I... Their women don't do this journey, and there are no women mining salt. Right. So there were times when I longed for my female friends and a bottle of Chardonnay, I will confess. But I know I will never do another journey like that. That was so, it had such an extraordinary impact on me. And it was just to experience a landscape in a way that was so unsullied. There was no engines, there was no tires. It was, you know, me and 4 men and 50 camels and, you know, a sack of dates and a sack of rice. And we would get up in the morning and the morning sometimes was 2 o'clock in the morning, and Rahman would shout, Adruna Thai! And that meant make tea, and you'd make a little fire using camel dung, and because, of course, there's no wood anywhere. And you'd make your tea in your little pot, and the first glass, it was served in glasses, was the glass that woke you up. It was like the shot of espresso. And then the second glass was the glass that you enjoyed, because the tea was its sort of perfect strength and delicious, because you poured water in between each glass.
Right.
And then the third glass was known as the child's tea, because by then the leaves had lost their potency and it was just kind of brown water. And it was, as I say, we had no common language, we had no common culture. They couldn't understand that we didn't know about camels. Why didn't we know about camels? Did we not have camels in our country?
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
No, I live in Shepherd's Bush. I think the most valuable lesson, I mean, it taught me that I had a resilience and a stubbornness and a toughness that I didn't realise I had. It taught me the value of traditional way of life, that it's valid. You know, we live in the Western world and, you know, look down on people who lead these sort of apparently old-fashioned, you know, who the hell trades salt anymore? And yet, for them, it was a honourable and very successful livelihood. But it was hard won. They worked incredibly hard, and they took great pride in it. And so to learn that, you know, something that we might write off as sort of ridiculously old-fashioned and impractical isn't. But I think the most important thing that I learned from that experience was that, you know, if somebody says, you should do something else. Like most people would say, you should have taken that BBC job. You know, you should have. No, I shouldn't. Mm. My heart and my gut told me do this journey, and I did it. And since, I don't know whether you can even go to Timbuktu anymore. It's been overrun by Al-Qaeda. That whole region has suffered desperately. If I hadn't done it in 1999, I'd be sitting here saying my biggest travel regret is that I didn't do it.
Oh, I'm so happy for you that you got to have that incredible life-changing experience. I feel like you must have had some connection there in a past life, potentially.
Yeah, it sort of felt like that.
Absolutely epic. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Pleasure.
Chapter 4 then, Kate, is the hardest one of all. Your all-time favourite destination. Where would you pick for that?
Well, funnily enough, I mean, it is the hardest one of all. But I was always of the mind that you didn't go back to places. You know, there was so much of the world to see. Mm. And as I say, you know, curiosity, you just want to keep finding new places. But about 11 or 12 years ago, I had an insane work schedule, and actually I was traveling all over the place for it. And I desperately, desperately needed a break. And I said to my husband, I don't really know. All my dates were kind of up in the air. It was just one of those kind of, everyone was being chaotic. And I said, right, let's try and book a week in August. And he's like, A, it's now June. We're never going to be able to find anywhere in August. And it's August. Why are we going away in August? You know, we don't have kids. We don't have to do that August thing. And I said, I know, but all the people I'm working with do have kids. So I think that's the most likely time that I'm going to be able to get a week
off. A window,
off,
yeah.
A window. And he said, oh, well, I don't know. What do you want to do? And I said, do you know what? I just want to find like a shack by a river somewhere. I want to eat tomatoes, swim in a river, read books. I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to speak to anyone. I don't want there to be any electricity or anything, any connection with the modern world. I just want that. And he's like, how are we going to find that? What do we put in Google? I said, okay, you leave that to me. Because
what do we put in Google? Yeah.
I said, you leave that to me because I'm a good researcher.
Yeah.
And I was working actually in West Wales at the time, and we had no phone signal, but we did have internet. And I found a shack on a lake in somewhere in France, and it sounded perfect. And it was through a website that I don't think exists anymore called Owners Direct. And so I sent it to, I said, look, this looks amazing. And I sent it to Ludo, and he phoned the couple whose name was listed on the website, and they said, we've just had a cancellation for the very week. And I was like, oh my goodness, amazing. And then, of course, I worried that actually it was going to be like some sort of centre parks, and there was going to be loads of cabins around a lake and people with jet skis, and it was going to be my dear sheer hell. But we just didn't have any choice by that stage. And then the owner said, now it's quite hard to find. So what we'll do is we'll meet you in the local village outside the supermarket and then you can follow. And I thought, well, that's a good sign.
Yes.
It can't be, you know, it can't be that on the beaten track if that's what has to happen. Oh my goodness, Holly. This little cabin was in a wood in, it's basically within the Limousin National Park. So it's the very, very north of the Dordogne. Mm-hmm. There's no kind of, you know, people think of the Dordogne and it's sort of, you know, it's Britain in France. You know, everyone goes there. They go for the Lascaux Caves. They go for the beautiful Dordogne villages. They go for the wine. They go blah, blah. This is the very north of the Dordogne. It's woody. It's actually not dissimilar to the Wye Valley. It's kind of rolling and wooded, but there's no kind of great attractions there. So it was perfect. And there was the most beautiful shack. Tiny, 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 totally off-grid. No electricity, nothing at all. On a lake, we would fall out of the shack, jump into the water with no clothes on, sit, eat tomatoes, read books. It was literally the most heavenly week I'd ever had.
It's what you dreamt of.
It was what I dreamt of. And at the end of the week, the owners came to make sure that everything had been okay. And I said to them, literally, this has been the best holiday I've ever had. And they recognised me and said, but you've been everywhere. And I said, not quite, but believe me, what you have here is really, really special. And I said, I actually bought my husband, Ludo, a book once called How to Build a Log Cabin. I've always wanted to have like a little cabin. Mm. He's never opened the blinking book. but I said, we've been having cabin fantasies. And they went, have you? And I said, well, you know, it's a bit like a holiday romance. You know, you take home a bottle of limoncello and then you never open it. I said, it's probably a bit like that. And they said, it's just that we know of a lake for sale just up the road. And I went, what? And they said, well, it's a funny thing in this part of France. People sell land, but actually mostly it's lake. And there are loads of these lakes and they were dug as fish ponds. And this particular lake, we know the people who are selling it. And it's got like a little kind of hut on at the side of it. Do you want to go and see it? And we're like looking and going, well, it's sort of 7 o'clock in the evening. We're leaving at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Of course we want to go and see it. We go and see it. It is the most heavenly, an acre of lake surrounded by trees in the middle of the wood with the ugliest little shack you have ever seen on the side of it.
Yeah.
And we just went, of course we're going to buy it. I don't know what with, we'll sell everything, but of course we're going to buy it. We've had that little shack on a lake in the middle of a French wood for 10 years. Aww. And it is my favourite place on earth.
Oh, how lovely. What a gorgeous connection to... And obviously so intertwined with nature as well, which is, I guess, why you love it so much.
Why I love it so much.
Oh, well, I mean, it sounds like the ultimate hidden gem, our next chapter, chapter five. But, I mean, you have been to some of the most remote places on the planet. Mm. When I think about a hidden gem, it's a place that you love that my listeners perhaps wouldn't know so much about or wouldn't have had the opportunity to experience.
Yeah.
So where comes to mind for that?
Well, I struggled with this one because, as you say, I have had the extraordinary privilege to be able to travel all over the place. And I came up with three.
Oh, excellent. I love that. Yes,
so
please.
I'll just go through them really quickly. One of them is a place called Daramacot. And Daramacot is an area of rainforest in Malaysian Borneo. And I went there because it is one of the best places in the world to see clouded leopard. And clouded leopard are a particularly beautiful cat. They're very difficult to see. Mm. I'm going to say, full disclosure, I spent a week there and I didn't see a clouded leopard.
Right.
But I did see extraordinary wildlife. It's not set up really for tourism. I stayed in an old forestry shack. Most of the stuff you're seeing at night, so you don't really sleep.
Right.
So it's a place for really hardcore wildlife enthusiasts. But if that's you, if you want to see orangutan during the day and incredible birds and then spend all night, and bearing in mind this is a rainforest as well, so you get very wet, you're in an open, very uncomfortable Land Rover bumping along one forestry track, you're in It's not primary forest. It's really interesting habitat. But I saw, every night we went out, I saw something we hadn't seen the day before. That doesn't happen very often. So it is, as I say, it's not for everybody at all. Certainly not your kind of first time, let's go and have a look at wildlife trip.
Mm.
But if you're hardcore and you don't mind getting wet and you don't want any creature comforts whatsoever, it is an astonishing location.
Ugh, I love
for
that.
Wildlife.
And you've also answered my next question, because I was going to ask you about like your ultimately, you know, intrepid wildlife experience. So that sounds like it certainly answers that one.
Yeah. Yeah. The other place is a place that I went to in the early 90s. So it may not be quite such a hidden gem anymore, but it's in Madagascar. I had longed to go to Madagascar, partly down to an astonishing woman called Hilary Bratt, who I'm sure you've heard of and who started the Bratt Guides. And she's been my kind of mentor and inspiration for very many years.
Right.
And the very first travel article I wrote was about Madagascar. It was the first one that I got published back in 1996. And I went to Madagascar in 95. And there was a place that I had read about. Again, it had almost mythical status, and it's called the Zingy de Bemera. And it is this extraordinary landscape that looks like another planet. And it's this highly eroded limestone plateau with deep crevasses and, you know, vegetation, flora and fauna that you do not get anywhere else. I mean, that for me was always the attraction of Madagascar, obviously, but this place is so extraordinary. There are limestone peaks that are as sharp as needles. Mm. These amazing, you know, the sort of what we call the elephant trees, these sort of pachyderm trees, these sort of long aerial roots. I mean, it is mind-blowing. It took us 9 days to get there, and we had to do it on foot and by boat. But it was absolutely worth it. It is extraordinary. It's probably a lot easier to get there now, and I hope it hasn't been too overrun. I mean, you know, it's a ridiculous thing to say about Madagascar, but it's a very, very, as a landscape, it blows your mind. Mm. It's like another world.
Oh, it sounds magical.
It's magical. And then the third place, again, it's a little bit out there, and I'm sorry to everybody who's going, well, I'm not going to Afghanistan. You've got to be kidding. But it is in Afghanistan. And a very dear friend of mine called Johnny Bilby, who runs a company called Wild Frontiers, which is a very ethical travel company.
Yeah.
And he has always, their travel, he's always wanted their travel to count and to support the communities in which they take their guests. And he had always been intrigued by the Silk Roads and by kind of Central Asia and that area. He knows Pakistan extremely well, but he knew about this area called the Wakhan Corridor in the very north of Afghanistan, and he was really intrigued by it. It's a mountainous area. The corridor itself is a valley that's, the valley floor is at 3,000 meters, so it's high altitude everywhere you go. And he just thought that it would be an amazing area for trekking. And he sent me on a recce there in 2009. And it was mind-blowing. It was so beautiful. The people, the Waki, the group that live in that part of Afghanistan, again, I mean, the hospitality, they're the most joyful people. I mean, we just laughed all the time. We had snowball fights. It was so special that when I was asked to do a documentary in around 2012 for the BBC, and it was about the history of shepherding, and they wanted to go somewhere that, you know, there was a sort of the feeling of what shepherding might have been like 10,000 years, or, you know, several thousand years ago. Sheep were first domesticated about 10,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent. So we're talking about that sort of region, of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And I said, we just go to the Wakhan, because they are shepherds and they are living and shepherding in a way that is probably unchanged for maybe not 10,000 years, but certainly 1,000. And so we went back, and the people, they remembered me.
Did they? Oh.
And it was just, it's a as I say, it's a very, very, very special place. And something that happens a lot is that whole countries get wiped off the visitor map because they have a bad rep. Mm. And Afghanistan, of course, has one of the most difficult reputations there is. But no country, no entire country or people should be written off just because of one part of it. And that was a good lesson to learn going to the Wakhan. And it is, yeah, it is a hidden gem. It's beautiful. Ugh,
it sounds amazing. And for intrepid walkers,
yeah,
a place to have on their bucket list. Well, in contrast to that absolutely magnificent sounding selection of hidden gems, chapter six, okay, is our penultimate chapter, and that is your worst travel experience or the place that you would just never go back to.
Well, it's, I'm very conscious of you know places being written off just because you've had a bad time maybe getting there, or you've eaten a bad meal, which isn't the fault of the place, it's just, you know, bad luck on that, yeah, particular day.
Totally.
I mean, for me, often the worst travel experience is nothing to do with the place and everything to do with, you know, an airport being rubbish, or, yeah, you know, a plane being cancelled or trains being delayed. I did have, and the other thing is, and you know this, Holly, as a traveller, that bad travel experiences make great stories. So actually, you know, is there really such a thing as a bad travel experience? I mean, I had a really difficult travel experience in Siberia. I was filming with reindeer, nomadic reindeer herders in Siberia in the winter, and to get to them we had to travel in what's called a truckle, and these are these basically special vehicles that can go across the tundra and go across snow and basically, you know, permafrost.
Yeah.
And they're immensely uncomfortable. They're basically like being in a giant biscuit tin with huge wheels that don't, you know, sink through the snow and everything else.
For someone with motion sickness, I feel like so many of your stories have involved very uncomfortable,
yeah,
vehicles.
I mean, this was spectacularly uncomfortable. And, you know, it's driven by somebody called Igor. And there were two of them. And we've got all our filming kit and our boxes and everything. And we are literally being rattled away. And it wasn't far. It was like, I don't know, I think it was barely 100 kilometres we were going. 9 hours into this journey, and there's no windows or anything. I mean, it's just horrendous. And it was minus 40. So everything was freezing. The diesel was freezing. The nuts that held the wheels on were freezing. Igor would get out and kind of bash something. And,
oh my God,
you know, it's pitch dark because, of course, this is Siberia in December. There's like half a minute of daylight. We got to a point where we broke down so catastrophically, we couldn't go anywhere. We couldn't do anything. And one vehicle just wasn't working. So the other vehicle was still working. And their answer was, we should go back. I'm like, we've traveled for 9 hours. There is no way we are going back. There has to be somewhere around here. And sure enough, we found this encampment of people. They were all the reindeer herders who had lost their herds through a dramatic winter storm and had ended up working in this, it was like a workhouse. I mean, these guys were desperate and miserable. It was like turning up into some, I don't know, just awful kind of medieval work camp. And they were living in, they were shipping containers. And there was a room that we were assigned with these sort of weird bunk beds that didn't have any mattresses. And so we got into this room and with all our stuff and think, well, we'll try and get some sleep. And we were kind of, I was sleeping
freezing
on the floor.
I imagine.
It was quite warm. It was warm in there.
Okay, well, that's something.
So that was something. There was nothing to eat. I mean, there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing. We're just ragged with exhaustion. I'm sleeping on the floor. You know, we're just kind of getting wherever we can get to. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, somebody tried to break through the door with an axe.
Oh, my God.
And at this point, we're just thinking, really? I mean, you know, and the only way they could get through life was to get really drunk and then really violent. So we had to push all the bunk beds, all our filming equipment, everything. We just had to ram it against the door to stop them breaking in.
Oh my God, how surreal. Like the whole thing just sounds like a weird,
it was a very, very surreal
film.
Thing. I can say that the rest of the journey, eventually when we got to meet a Nanette family who took us in, they were incredible. I mean, I've never known temperatures like it. The coldest day we had was minus 54. And that, I mean, you can't function.
No.
But they, again, you know, once we were with them and I was living in their chum, which is a teepee, but they call it a chum. I was living with them and it was wonderful. But that journey to get there, my goodness.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Kate, it has just been such a joy to chat to you today, hearing your travel diaries all around the world. We're on to our final chapter now, chapter 7. And that is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list. Where is left for you to discover?
Well, lots, actually. Yeah. And again, I'm afraid I couldn't narrow it down to one. I'd love to walk across Japan. I used to work for a Japanese company. I have been to Tokyo Airport and no further.
Oh, wow. So you've got all of Japan
to discover. So I've got all of Japan to discover. And I thought, I'm not a city person, as you know. I don't particularly have any wish to go to Tokyo or to the big Japanese cities. But everything I've read and heard about it, there's wonderful wildlife, there's beautiful, you know, there's beautiful mountain landscapes. And I do love a mountain. So I'd love to walk across Japan. But similarly, there's a long distance walk in Wales, right on my doorstep, called the Glyndŵr Way. And I've done a couple of long distance walks in Wales. I've walked across the Brecon Beacons, 100 miles across the Brecon Beacons, and I've walked the Wye Valley. But the Glyndŵr Way is on my list. And then again, not particularly exotic, but just places that I would really love to go to. Poland properly. Again, for the wildlife, Romania, the same.
Oh,
Albania,
yeah.
Those sort of Central European countries that perhaps get a little bit overlooked, but I would love to go to those.
Wow. Well, we'll have to keep watch and see where you head to next. How exciting. The world is our oyster.
It is.
Kate Humble, those were your travel diaries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Oh, a huge thank you to the lovely Kate Humble, another guest who was originally on my dream guest wish list, and what a fabulous storyteller she is. And speaking of storytelling, Kate has a new book out called Where the Hearth Is, Stories of Home, which interestingly, given that we spoke mostly about travel, is all about home, questioning the notion of home. Is it a tangible place or is it a state of mind? And it considers the views of lots of others living uniquely, extraordinarily and happily. It is a fascinating and really comforting read, which I thoroughly recommend. A great Christmas present, I think. And thank you again to the Chelsea Townhouse for having us. And thank you so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who is joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Threads and TikTok. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until next week, remember, there's the first 9 seasons to catch up on. That's over 100 episodes to keep you busy there. Don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app, and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks again, everyone. Take care, and I'll be back next week.